Thank you so much. And again, I'd like to humbly introduce Chad P. from Austin. Please, everybody, give him a warm welcome.
Okay, is it my turn now? We ready? Okay, good. All right. My name's Chad Payne. I'm an alcoholic. This thing keeps popping up to speaker view. I'm trying to get it over to gallery view because I don't want to see myself so big. There, let's see how that goes. Okay, first thing I want to say, what an honor. And God dang, thank you for the introduction. That was really sweet. And what an honor it is to be here. I've been hearing about Club 12 for a long time. And, you know, there's a lot of folks all around AA that know that you guys are doing some really good work over there. And I'm sure grateful for that. It's these pockets of enthusiasm, these people who are in love with AA, those you're my people. And it's a big honor to get to come share with you at the 71st anniversary. Wow, that's a big deal. So thank you so much, Suzanne, for asking me and anyone else who had anything to do with me being here. I really appreciate it. Let's see. I've been sober since April 2nd, 2003. That's 17 years, which means there are probably quite a few folks watching me here tonight that have been sober a lot longer than me. But I'll tell you, 17 years is a lot longer than I intended on being sober, and it's a big deal for me. I am really, really grateful for 17 years, and I can tell you, at 17 years, I'm in a much better place than I was at one or two, so I'm sure grateful for it. My home group is the Primary Purpose Group in Austin. We meet on Tuesday nights in person at the Austin New Church. For now, you know, we'll see how it goes. It's all kind of touch and go. But for now, we're meeting in person. We've got the chairs set 6 feet apart, and we're wearing masks, and we've got hand sanitizer around. And then we had to make some signs, you know, talking about what it is that we're doing to keep the room sanitary and how we're supposed to act and maintain social distance. And we decided it was probably a good idea to put on the sign that, please use the hand sanitizer on your hands, but please don't drink it. It is considered a relapse. I have a girlfriend who works in drug and alcohol treatment, and she took the girls down to the animal shelter in here in Austin to do service. You know, they get them out every so often to do some service to kind of introduce them to the idea of being of service. And I was texting with her on that day, and I said, so how's it going? And she said, oh, it was going great until one of our girls drank the hand sanitizer. Now we have to go home. It's like, oh man, you know, that's wanting a drink. And I sure understand that, but you know, I never drank hand sanitizer, but I can imagine it's rough going down, you know? Whew. Anyway, let's do an AA talk. I want to welcome anybody. I put the Austin, before I move on, we're meeting Wednesday nights on Zoom. So the online meeting's on Wednesday nights, the in-person's meeting on Tuesday nights. They're both at 7:30, but I put the information, or I put the website here in the chat box. So if you're interested in finding out any information on that, either look it up there on the website or send me an email. What a gift Zoom has been for Primary Purpose Group. A few months ago, sometime in March, we realized that we weren't going to be able to meet. And I thought, one of our home group members call me, and she said, hey, we need to get Primary Purpose Group going online. We can use this new Zoom format, and I know how to get it going. And I was like, rock on, get it done. I didn't want anything to do with it. And I just thought we'd be back in person in a couple weeks, you know. And so thankfully we have some ambitious home group members who got that thing going and then kind of forced me to get involved with it. And next thing you know, we had to jump up. The 100 limit wasn't enough. Then the 500 limit wasn't enough. We had to jump up to the 1000 limit. We had, after Founders Day, when Katie and Charlie both mentioned Primary Purpose Group in their talks, we had over 600 people. And that's just the number of Zoom accounts. We also had treatment centers. I sponsor guys that work in treatment, and I found out that we probably have you know, sometimes 700 or 800 people. We have people staying up to 1 or 2 in the morning in Ireland, or, you know, people from New Zealand and Australia and South Africa all, you know, coming to the group. So it's been a really, in for some of these established members in AA that are kind of out in the middle of nowhere and really don't have the kind of big book message that's coming through at Club 12 or coming through at Primary Purpose Group, and that may not be getting that, have really had an opportunity to open their eyes to some different kind of you know, to me, real Alcoholics Anonymous recovery. So that's been really cool to get to be a part of it. Anyway, I want to welcome anybody to everybody to come check us out. We're a little bit different. We study the book really slowly, and we do something kind of weird. We don't share our experience. Some experience filters in here and there, but the idea is not to share our experience, to really discuss what the book is saying. So when I first came to Primary Purpose Group about 11 years ago, I thought, this is wrong. This is not how you do AA. This is not how we did it in Oklahoma, where I came from. And what you guys are doing here is just, and I didn't like it. And then I started hearing some stuff that was kind of ringing my bell. And I was thinking, wait a minute. It says to do that in the book, and they're discussing how to do it, and I don't do that. And it says it right here. So it kind of hit my ego a little bit, you know. It kind of hit me right in the pride. And I came back, and then next thing you know, after 3 or 4 meetings, I started falling in love with it. But anyway, we're going to move on here. Let's get an AA talk going. On page 29 in the big book, it says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. And that's my job here tonight. I want to talk to you guys about how that relationship was established. And the interesting thing about it is it didn't necessarily start when I came to AA. It didn't start when I took a third step or when I had a spiritual awakening. It didn't start, you know, when I was, I don't even know how old I was, but at some point I was joined a church that we never really went to, and, you know, things like that. This relationship started way back before I ever knew it was starting. Because what happened is there's a series of events in my life that paved the way to a surrender. You know, so the question then is, what is it that drove an arrogant, closed-minded, self-centered alcoholic like me to seek a relationship with God? And that's kind of how this starts. Now, as a kid, childhood, you know, I was rocking along doing pretty good. Had friends, got along well with adults, did well in school, played some sports. Things were looking pretty good. I come from a loving but dysfunctional family. I was always very well loved. I've heard enough fifth steps to know that I had it a lot better than a lot of people had it. But on the other hand, my family was pretty dysfunctional too. A lot of divorce, for instance, you know, just 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had to make a quick trip up to Oklahoma because my half brother's stepdad, wait a minute, that's not right. It's my half brother's ex stepdad. Actually, that's funny, but I'm going to throw out the tragedy. So, but anyway, he committed suicide due to alcoholism. So, you know, when I start describing, I was telling the story one time about my sister's brother, and somebody said, wait a minute, isn't your sister's brother your brother? And I was like, well, not really. I mean, there's a lot. So it's just one of those kind of families, but here's the best way I can describe it. I grew up with, there were 6 of us in the home, stepbrothers and sisters and real brother and stepdad, mom. But anyway, there were 6 of us for the majority of my childhood growing up in the home. And out of 6 of us, 5 of us either currently are or at some time have been members of 12-step fellowships. Now, that's all cool when you're sitting around the Thanksgiving table today and we're talking about the 12 steps and surrender and God and things like that. But getting to that point was sometimes kind of difficult. But anyway, that's kind of where I come from. I was doing pretty good until about 7th grade. When I hit junior high, some stuff started coming to the surface, some fear, some anxiety, some tension, the feeling that I wasn't enough, that I didn't fit in, that I wasn't a part of, that so many of us can relate to, that happened somewhere there along the way. And a couple years after 7th grade, I mean, it was a rough couple years, but finally the miracle happened. I had my first drink. And it was a big deal. I didn't know it at the time. All I knew at the time is this is a lot of fun and I'm going to keep on doing it. What I didn't know is that alcohol opened up a whole new world for me. It got me out of this very limited, closed down mind. It's almost like it opened my heart. Dave, you mentioned at the beginning of this, we're going to take a moment of silence to quiet the mind and open the heart. That's what alcohol did for me. That's such a great way of describing it. I got out of here and into the world with you guys. I didn't feel like I wasn't good enough or I wasn't a part of. None of that stuff was ever true, but I didn't feel it anymore. I felt like I fit in, like I was supposed to be here. As a matter of fact, like you were lucky to be here with me. That's how I felt when I drank, and life became an adventure instead of a chore. Actually, what happened for me is when I drank, what happened was a lot like a spiritual experience. A lot. It's the closest thing that I had ever known to one, that's for sure. But at the time, I didn't know all that. All I knew is it was a lot of fun and I was going to keep on doing it. And I did keep on doing it. You know, I did it. And anything that kind of stood in the way, it had to get moved out of the way to continue drinking. My dad came to me when I was 18 years old. I think it right after I graduated high school. And he said, son, you're 18 now. You're out of high school. It's time for you to put all this drinking behind you, straighten up and go on and live a good life. And I can remember even back then thinking, dude, if you had any idea what you were asking of me, you wouldn't ask it. That is way too much to ask. And obviously you don't understand. And he didn't. Why would he? You know, why would people understand people like me? Okay, so many of us in AA can relate to that, right? Right? Nod your head if you can relate to that. Did life was not good, and then I drank, and then life was good. Yeah, okay. But here's what's interesting. That's not what makes me alcoholic. Lots of people experience that. There are teenagers all over the world that are very uncomfortable in their own skin, and they take a few drinks, smoke a joint, do some pills, I don't know, whatever we're doing now, whatever it is, and then they're okay. Are they all alcoholic? No. No, some grow right out of it, you know? So then what is it that makes me alcoholic? On page 30 in the big book, it says, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people has to be smashed. Strong language, right? Smashed. That's how it is with people like me. You have to smash a delusion. You can't just mention it in passing. I mean, AA had their work cut out when I showed up, you know. We had to smash some delusions. I was not an easy guy to work with. So if I'm going to fully concede to my innermost self, concede means just surrender. So if I'm going to fully surrender to my innermost self, now by innermost self, if you want to know if I fully surrendered to my innermost self, don't ask me, watch me. Because the only way you're going to know is by seeing what I do. So if I'm going to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic, guess what? I need to know what it means to be alcoholic. Because I knew I was a drunk. I would have admitted that way years before I ever showed up in AA. But to really understand what it means to be alcoholic is a whole different story. You see, there's a big difference in a drunk and an alcoholic, and I'll get to that in just a second. So what does that mean to be alcoholic? First, I have an alcohol problem. Book calls it a physical allergy. I call it an alcohol problem. And here's what my problem with alcohol is. When I start drinking it, I lose control over how much I drink. I'd come off a construction job. I'd come home and my wife and I never got along. The reason we never got along is because when she got pregnant, we both made a commitment that we were going to straighten up, quit drinking, and be good parents. Well, she did, and I meant to, right? I did not show up the way I committed to show up at all. Not even close. As a matter of fact, I got worse. So we rarely ever got along. We fought all the time. And usually the fights would end with me leaving. I'm out of here, you know, whatever. But on this night, the night I'm about to tell this story from, this night we were getting along. I'd come off a construction job. We were in the house. I was sober. We were in the house. We were watching a movie. My daughter was playing on the floor. She's about a year old or so. And it was getting kind of late. And my wife said, "Hey, I'm going to put Abby to bed. I'm hungry. Why don't you go grab us a bite to eat? When you get back, we'll eat and finish watching this movie." Good plan. As I'm walking out the door, I lean in and say, "Hey, I love you. I'll be back in 20 minutes. With a smile on my face, because these things were good. And you could have hooked a lie detector up to me and said, "Wait a minute, Chad, you swear to God you're going to be back in 20 minutes? And I would have said, "Yes, I do." And I would have passed with flying colors. My intentions were to be back in 20 minutes. I'm driving to go get tacos, man. What else are you going to eat at 9 o'clock at night while you're watching a movie? On the way to get tacos. And as I'm going to get those tacos, I start thinking, you know, I got some days off before I go on another job. Tomorrow, my wife was taking classes in college. She'll be in school. I'll get my daughter up in the morning. We'll spend quality time together. I'll take her to daycare, and then I'll go pick up my buddy Michael, and we'll go drink a few beers and go on an adventure. I'm from southeast Oklahoma. That probably involves something with a four-wheel drive pickup truck and some mud and some guns and, you know, and some drinking and all that kind of thing. So that was my plan. On the way back with the tacos in my truck, I decided, you know, I'm going to swing by Michael's and let him know that I'm coming tomorrow. So I stopped by and I knocked on the door. And, of course, he answered. And he's drinking at the time. And there's a party going on behind him. And he says, "Come on in, man. Come see everybody." And I'm like, "No, I gotta go home. I got tacos in the truck, but I'm going to come get you tomorrow. I got a pocket full of money. We're going to go have some fun." He's like, "Cool, man. That's great." And then I see somebody over there in the back. I'm like, "Oh, hey, what's going on?" Next thing you know, I'm in the house. And next thing you know, I have a drink. And then the next thing you know, it ain't 9 o'clock anymore. Now it's midnight. And I have this overwhelming thought. Here it is. Check this out. See if you can relate to this thought. I can't go home now. Because if I go home now, I'll be in big trouble. Next thing I know, it's daylight. The party's still going. I'm telling my buddy Michael, "Bro, we got to get out of here. She's going to come find me. Somebody will call the cops. It's not, my daughter will be in tow. It's not going to be good." So we left. So what happens is my 20-minute trip to go get tacos takes 2 weeks. But it's not like I come home in 2 weeks. It's like 2 weeks later, I get caught sneaking my golf clubs out of the garage at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's how I showed up as a father, and that's how I showed up as a husband. When I take alcohol, alcohol takes me. And I don't know what's going to happen because I also have a mental problem. I don't know what's going to happen, but it happens. You know, and the interesting thing is that thought that happened at midnight. Remember that thought that hit me at midnight? That thought that said, "I can't go home now because if I go home now, I'll be in big trouble." The way I understand that today is I have something going on in my body, and that tells my mind, we must have more alcohol. That message from my body tells my mind, we're not done drinking. So I don't care what you have to tell yourself to keep us out drinking. You tell it, because we ain't going home, because if we go home, we have to stop drinking. So I tell myself something crazy. See, had I gone home at midnight, we could have salvaged something out of that. You know, it didn't make sense, but it doesn't matter because I had to keep drinking. That's not the only problem I have, though, because if an alcohol problem is the only health problem I have, all I have to do is quit drinking. If I'll quit, Dr. Silkworth tells us right there in the doctor's opinion. He says, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Now, if you're like me, when you first heard those words, entire abstinence, whether that was in AA or in treatment or wherever it was, when I heard entire abstinence, I just shuddered. What do you mean? Like nothing ever? Are you out of your mind? But that's the solution that we have to offer for an alcohol problem, physical allergy, the craving. Is the lack of control when I start drinking. The solution is, well, if you can't control it, don't do it. And you hear it in AA all over the world. Just don't drink no matter what. Bro, I drink no matter what. You know? just put the plug in the jug. You don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. That's all great advice unless you're an alcoholic like me. Because if you're an alcoholic like me, not only do you have an alcohol problem, you have a mental problem. See, I have a mental problem. I am insane when it comes to alcohol, and here's what that looks like. I'm insane in a lot of ways, especially when I first came in. But the insanity that I'm talking about, the insanity that makes me alcoholic is real simple, and here's what it is. I don't care how bad it got last time. I don't care what kind of consequences I'm facing in the future. I don't care how much I want, how strong the desire is. I cannot maintain the status of not drinking. I can't do it. I will pick up another drink. It's just a matter of time. Now, on page 24, it tells me that I don't have a choice. I'm not going to read it. It just paraphrases. I don't have a choice. I don't have a choice over whether or not I take the first drink. Not only am I powerless over what happens once I start drinking, I'm also powerless, stone cold sober over the first drink. But here's the tricky part. The book says it, and so does my experience. It says at certain times, I don't have the power of choice. It's tricky, right? I'll have the power of choice for a certain amount of time. I can say no, and I can say no again, and I can say no. No, 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 no. No, I swore off. No, 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 no. I learned while I was in AA that if I just, even if I just drink a beer, I'm off to the races. I'm not going to do it. No, I'm not drinking, right? And I can make that choice again and again and again, and oops, not this time. This time, I pick up the drink. Sometimes it's like I can't just take it. I just can't take it anymore. Sometimes I don't even know what's happening. And I'm going, whoa, what happened? I wasn't going to drink. See, because if you're like me, you can't just maintain the decision not to drink most of the time. It's got to be all the time. 9 out of 10 is not enough for me. 99 out of 100 is not enough. I've got to be able to not pick up a drink every single time. And I don't have the power to do that on my own. And that's what makes me alcoholic. You know, the book talks about this mental obsession. And I always like to throw that in somewhere because sometimes I think that there's a misunderstanding of what that looks like. Or maybe I'm the one that misunderstands it, but I'm the one that's not muted. So here's the way I see it. So this obsession, right? This obsession, when I'm out there drinking and running and gunning, it's a voice and it goes, hey, Chad, let's drink today. And I'm like, all right, rock on, let's drink. But then bad things happen, so I quit. I ain't drinking no more, man, because if I drink again, I know I'll lose my job, lose my family, go to jail, all those kind of things, right? So then the obsession changes its course a little bit. It says, look, Chad, let's just have a couple of beers. That's no big deal. You can even leave your keys at home. That way you're sure not to drink and drive. You won't get arrested. Stay off the hard stuff. Right? It starts talking to me and eventually talks me into it. I'm like, yeah, I can do that. Anybody can do that. I'll quit after two, whatever, right? But that doesn't work. So then I come to AA or I learn something in treatment or whatever it might be. Somebody teaches me a little bit about alcoholism. And so then now here I am in AA. I'm going to meetings and I'm just not drinking no matter what. And that the obsession says, hey, Chad, let's drink. And I say, nope, I quit. I'm about being sober now. I'm in AA. I'm not doing it. And then the voice, that little voice, the obsession says, but hey, man, let's just have a couple of beers. That's all. Let's just swing by the bar after work, have a couple beers, go straight home. No big deal. You can chew some gum. Nobody will ever even know. And I say, nope, those people in AA, they taught me I have a physical allergy. Once I start to drink, I lose control. And who knows what, right? So then the voice says, okay, all right, we'll take a different course. Let's try this. Let's try this. Hey, Chad, you don't need to tell your sponsor about this. You can handle this one on your own. Or, hey, Chad, you don't need to make all those amends. That's just digging up the past. Or you don't really have the money to pay all that back. Wait until you have the money to go see those people. Or, hey, Chad, you're really busy right now. You really don't have time to sponsor people. You can just set up some chairs and clean out some ashtrays, and we'll call that service work. You don't really, you can sponsor people later on when you have more time. right? So that voice that says to me, hey, man, you're running late for work. You don't have time to pray and meditate this morning. You can do it tomorrow. So here's what that voice does. It does the same thing I used to do to my little brother. When I was a kid, I could get my little brother to do whatever I wanted. I could talk him into anything, but there was a trick. First, I had to get him away from the rest of the family because they would tell him, they would say, hey, just ignore your brother. You don't have to do what he says. So I'd have to get him away from that. I had to get him by himself. And then I would be very persistent. And finally, he would be like, ah, whatever. I don't care. And he would just do it. Right? Well, that's the same thing the obsession does to an alcoholic. First, it has to get me away from you. It has to get me away from the program. It has to get me away from God. And once it has me alone, then it just has to be persistent and I'll eventually give in. And that's what I'm dealing with. And I don't care how much self-knowledge I have. I don't have a chance against that voice on my own power. So what happened for me is eventually that wife left. I had a bad wreck. I crashed into a tree. I broke a bunch of bones. I spent like a month in the hospital. Had surgery on my hip, my jaw, shoulder, all kinds of stuff. I got out of the hospital. I was on a walker with my jaws wired shut. And I did, I was under the influence, you know, when I had the wreck and everybody knew that. And my family gathered around. I'd pushed the family away, but they showed up, you know, my crazy dysfunctional family showed up and I looked them in the eye one after another when I got home from the hospital and I said, I'm done. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm going to get my life together. I'm going to go back to school, be a good dad, be a good son. I'm going to do all these things. I lasted 2 days, and I was staying out all night getting loaded. After 2 days on a walker with my jaws wired shut, you know, can you just imagine me on a walker drinking with a cigarette hanging out my mouth? I mean, out all night? God. My wife left, took my kid. I mean, it was about time. I ended up, before you knew it, I was homeless, just miserable. Every day I was going to stop. I was done. And every day I couldn't make it a day, you know, and that went on for a while longer. They did an intervention on me finally. It's funny. They actually did an intervention on my brother and he walked out. He was like, hell no, you guys can have this. I'm out. So they thought, well, we already hired an interventionist and we already have a bed in a treatment center. Let's try Chad. You know, what the hell? I mean, it'll never work. But what they didn't know is that I was so far down and so miserable that actually they had a better chance with me than they did my brother. And so they sent me off to this treatment center. Now, we've got these really good treatment centers around this part of the country, right, where they're getting the 12 steps and they're getting good clinical stuff and there's these follow-up programs and all this stuff, right? That's not like where I went. Here's the best way I can describe the treatment center I went to. We took my biggest resentment. I wrote it on a balloon and let it go. And it didn't work. I still had to write inventory and make amends later, you know, but it's a good idea. I mean, what if that did work? Wouldn't it be great if that worked? Just buy a pack of balloons, you know, anyway, it doesn't work. Okay. So anyway, here's what this treatment center did though. They took me to meetings a lot. They introduced me to you guys. I met the people who understood me and they were not drinking and they were happy. What? It was so cool. I got out of that treatment center, and here's what I knew I was supposed to do. I knew I was supposed to go to meetings. I knew I was supposed to get involved. And I did it, man. I mean, I had a big surrender to alcohol. I was clear that I was going to have to do this, but I didn't know about working the steps. I'm sure people were talking about it, but I wasn't hearing it. So here's what I did. I went to at least one meeting a day. If it was a bad day, I'd call in sick to work and go to like five. I was showing up early. I was staying late. I was giving people rides to and from meetings. I was chairing meetings. I was cleaning out ashtrays. I was doing it all. It was downtown Oklahoma City, and homeless guys would show up at the meeting, and I would take them to the referral center or to go to get groceries. I was doing what I – and I was talking to him in the car about what I had learned in treatment, right? I wasn't giving him any kind of an AA message. I was just talking to him about that stuff I had learned there, you know. And And I stayed sober, but I stayed sick. So I finally reached a point, less than a year sober, less than a year, where this going to meetings wasn't enough anymore. I was just about done with, I'd quit this home group and gone to this one and quit. And this guy shared the same stuff all the time. And I wanted to hear from this guy, but he didn't share it out. What, you know, and I was just hanging in there. I was staying sober till I made it to the meeting and then I could go home. Right. And I was just about done with that. I'd built up so many resentments. I had this self-pity thing going, like, why do I have to live this way? This is so stupid. And I was ready to go be a normal person, right? And then I met the guy. And God put this guy in my life and put me in his life at exactly the right time. He set me down after the meeting. He 12-stepped me. He explained what was wrong with me. And when he started explaining all that, I was going, yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's me. I did that. You did this. I did this, you know. But here's where it got really disturbing. Somewhere in that conversation, I realized that my sobriety was not guaranteed. As a matter of fact, I was on a quick route out the door and I wasn't going to stay sober. And it was very disturbing. You know, I was thinking, oh no, this is bad news. And I try to carry that into my 12-step calls today. You know, when I'm 12-stepping someone, I'm not bringing them hope. I'm bringing them hopelessness. I'm trying to crush hope. I want them to understand that you're not just a drunk, you're an alcoholic. Here's the difference. A drunk has a problem. An alcoholic doesn't have an answer. And if I am finally very clear that I don't have an answer, I'm ready to do all this weird stuff you guys are about to ask me to do because I'm clear that I don't have the power to stay sober on my own. I'm in a hopeless state, and that's where I need to get to before I'm open to the ideas that you guys are going to bring me. So here's what this guy, Dave, here's what after he disturbed me so deeply with this 12-step call. Then I'm just sitting there like, oh no. And he said, Chad, do you know what you need? And I said, no, Dave, what do I need? And he said, you need a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps. And I was like, oh, I'd been hearing that in a reading every night. That's what they're talking about. And all of a sudden it made sense to me. Now, that brings in a whole new problem because I'm agnostic. Uh-oh. And for years, I've been saying I'm agnostic, but I mean, the truth is, really, I came in atheist, you know, pretty, very atheist. And I wasn't just like atheist to a Christian God. It wasn't like a church problem I had. What I had was all this, I don't care if it's Native American, Mother Nature, meditation, all that's just nonsense. That's the way I looked at it, right? Prayer is just silly. Like, who am I talking to? Me? I mean, what are you? This is ridiculous. That's the guy that came in. That's what I was bringing in. But here's what I understood. And this is the most important thing for a guy like me. And I work with so many agnostics and atheists today. They seem to be drawn to me. I'm drawn to them. And here's the most important thing a guy like me has to understand is that I have two alternatives. As an alcoholic, I have two alternatives. I can either die an alcoholic death or I can live on a spiritual basis. So what I like to challenge guys with, because I used to say I have a step two problem, but here's what I like to challenge guys with is this. If great, step two problem, cool. I have all kinds of problems with AA. As a matter of fact, I kind of have a problem with the not drinking part, right? Lots of us have lots of problems with AA. But if you have a step two problem that keeps you from moving on with the rest of the work, it's not a step two problem. It's a step one problem. Because if I'm clear on step one, I don't have to approve of the process. Bring it on and I'll do it. To me, that's the most important thing an agnostic or atheist like me can understand. It's a step one problem, not a step two problem. We went through the 12 steps. I had an amazing spiritual experience, even though I didn't believe in what he was talking about. I still had the experience. You know, that's why we can have the whatever conception of a higher power that we want, is because we're not about beliefs in AA. We're about an experience. That's what AA has to offer, a spiritual experience. And the thing is, if you do the work, you have the experience. So what I like to tell guys is, great, I hear what you're saying about what you believe. That's all good. It makes for an interesting conversation. But what I would like for you to do is set all that stuff aside, take the 12 steps, and then tell me what you believe, because it's going to change. I moved down to Austin when I had about 5 years. I met Charlie and Katie. I became a member of the Primary Purpose Group, and I learned so much about the Big Book, about the third step, which meant something completely different than what I thought it meant. I learned so much about the disciplines of steps 10 and 11. I learned so much about what it means to actively carry the message. So much stuff opened up for me. It was a whole new level of spiritual living for me. I thought this third step was just a prayer and move on to the next step. What I didn't understand is that in the third step, that's where I learned what's blocking me from having a spiritual awakening. Bill said it himself. He said in his story on the bottom of page 13, top of page 14, he says, you can have a new relationship with your Creator and the elements of a way of living which will solve all your problems. I came in with problems. Anybody else come in with problems? Okay, you can have a new relationship with your Creator and the elements of a way of living which solves all your problems, but a price had to be paid. That price is destruction of self-centeredness, because self-centeredness is what's blocking me from the spiritual awakening that is necessary for me to recover from alcoholism. And that's what the rest of the work is based on, is the reduction or the freedom from self-centeredness. It's just introduced to me in the third step. So even on page 62, it's interesting. It says above everything for the alcoholic, above everything, he must stop drinking, right? No, that's not what it says. But it says above everything, he must develop a relationship with God. No, that's not what it says either. Here's what it says. Above everything, you must be rid of this selfishness. Isn't that interesting? Like, you're telling me the most important thing in my life is to be rid of this selfishness. As an alcoholic, that's the most important. That's what the book is saying. And here's the way that I understand this today. My natural state as a child of God is one of God consciousness. That's my natural state as a child of God. Now, somewhere along the way, starting in childhood and then carrying through a bunch of crazy years of drinking and then crazy years of sobriety, I'm blocked from that flow of God consciousness. So the work that I do in AA, the inventory, reading it to somebody, taking it to God, cleaning up the past, prayer and meditation, constant self-examination, accountability through a sponsor, working with others, all that stuff is designed to bring the self-will down. And the automatic result of the self-will going down is the God consciousness going up. And that's how we have a spiritual awakening. It's not about doing anything. It's about undoing what it is that's blocking me. The other thing that I learned, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here at Club 12. The other big thing that I learned, I was a part of a group in Oklahoma City that was very responsible and a very good group. Good group. But the way that they taught me to carry the message was, show up at your home group, share your experience, strength, and hope, and wait for that newcomer to come ask you for your phone number. You give him your phone number, and then you wait for him to call. Well, that all sounds great. Problem was, by that method, there I was with 3, 4, 5 years sober and maybe one sponsee. And I was doing my job, But what I was not experiencing was the joy of devoting my life to working with others. When I came to Austin, Charlie, Katie, Primary Purpose Group, they told me that's not going to cut it, Chad. If you want to experience what this program has to offer, you go out and actively carry the message. And I said, wait a minute, this is a program of attraction rather than promotion. And then it was pointed out to me, Chad, that's the 11th tradition. That's our public relations policy. That is not our philosophy in the 12th step. Our philosophy in the 12th step is to actively carry the message. They said to me, look, Chad, if you want to carry this message of what you've been given, if you want to take people through the steps, experience the joy of working with others, then you're going to have to go find them. And so I did. I made it my mission. And I started studying the book with the intent of how to carry the message. I started going down to halfway houses and treatment centers and the clubhouses that attracted a lot of the newcomers. I started and then I would look for my guy. I would be in the meeting and I would look for my, oh, that guy is definitely not smiling. That's the guy I'm going to go bother after this meeting. Sometimes I wouldn't bother him. Sometimes I would say, hey, man, I'd love to visit with you for a minute. Can I buy you a cup of coffee and we hang out outside? And every now and then I'd get one of those guys. And then what I would do is I would trick him. Somewhere in that conversation, I would turn it into a 12-step call. And without ever mentioning the word sponsor, next thing you know, we've covered the problem and the solution. And then I tell him, so if you work the steps, you can have what we have. And I'd be happy to show you how to do that. And every now and then that guy would say, cool, I'd like to do that. So then I would start setting up times and start taking this guy through the steps. And then next thing you know, somebody would say, it looks like Chad's your sponsor. And he's going, what's a sponsor? You know, but anyway, that's kind of what I started doing. Now, the point to that is I actively went, next thing you know, I had 5 sponsees. Next thing you know, I had 10. Next thing you know, I'm not calling my sponsor with my problems. I'm calling him with how to help these guys with their problems. And my life radically changed. So what I do today is I sponsor a lot of guys. I wake up in the morning. Don't tell my sponsor this, but I do the 11-step review in the morning before I pray and meditate. I put it on paper. I ask God for corrective measures. I get clear in my mind for a minute, and I write whatever comes to mind, kind of like an active listening to God kind of thing. Then I do some prayer and meditation. Throughout the day, I try to practice the 10th step. I watch my thinking. I watch when I'm in collision with somebody, when I might be disturbed, whatever that is. I take it to God. I talk to somebody about it. I clean it up best I can if I've caused some damage. And I try to turn my thoughts to how I can be of service to others. I've made my amends, all the ones that I know of. I'm sure there are plenty out there that I'm not aware of, but I'm willing whenever the awareness comes up. And I'm sure that there are many more harms that I'm going to commit because I am recovered from alcoholism, but I'm still a raving lunatic sometimes. So I try to clean that stuff up as I go. I'm a member of my home group and I try to stay involved there, even though sometimes it takes a little push to get me going in the right direction. And I do my best to be a good member of AA. And in the process, I get to help some people. And then the cool thing about it is when that's my focus, I experience the freedom that this program has to offer. So I didn't tell Suzanne this. I don't think I did. I took on another commitment that starts at 7. So as soon as I'm done here, I'm going to have to jump off here and I told them I was going to log on a little late. They've got a lot of things to do before they get to me, but I'm going to jump on and do that one. It's been a real honor to be here with you guys. But here's the last thing I want to say. On page 62 in the big book, it tells me I got to quit playing God. Do you guys know why I have to quit playing God? It tells me in the next time. It says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Here's why. It didn't work. It didn't work. Then they take me all through this process of these steps. And over here on page 88, right before we start working with others, I love this line. It says, it works. It really does. And that's why we do it. Thank you. It's been an honor.